Okay, I'd like to go ahead and begin today's seminar by introducing Charles Maurice. Many of you know him from EPA's Region 5. Charles, I'm going to turn it over to you now for the introduction of today's session and our first speaker.
Thank you, Larry. I'm Chuck Maurice of the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and I want to welcome everyone to Risky Learning, a web seminar series sponsored by the Superfund Basic Research Program of the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences in collaboration with the United States Environmental Protection Agency. This seminar series was developed by the people listed on the first slide of today's set of slides. They are affiliated with the organizations listed, the Superfund Basic Research Program, the Environmental Protection Agency, and MBD. We'd like to thank the committee and Fluen for their participation. Today's session is Nanoparticles and Ecotoxicology, the eighth in a nine-part web seminar series covering applications and implications of nanotechnology as it pertains to the Superfund program. We will have our final session on November 8th from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and its title will be Nanotechnology and Superfund, Looking Ahead. And it will feature Dr. Randy Wenzel, who is the National Program Director for EPA Research of Contaminated Sites and Resource Conservation, and David Rajewski, Director of the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Woodrow Wilson Center. The topics of discussion at this next session will be future directions for research and policy in nanotechnology. So mark your calendars now for November 8th. To date, these nanotechnology seminars have highlighted the potential of nanotechnology to support characterization and remediation of hazardous waste sites, as well as an exploration of the unknowns and potential risks of this class of compounds. Today's presentation will touch on ecotoxicology of engineered nanomaterials. We will have two speakers today. The first speaker of today's seminar is Dr. Steve Klaney, who is a professor in the Institute for Environmental Toxicology at Clemson University in Clemson, South Carolina. Dr. Klaney received his BS in biology from the University of Cincinnati and his master's and PhD in environmental science from Rice University. His research has focused on the fate and effects of contaminants in the environment and has recently become involved in nanomaterials focusing on studies with carbon nanotubes. The title of his talk, Nanomaterials in the Environment, Carbon in Aquatic Ecosystems. So now please welcome Dr. Klaney.
Thanks, Charles. I appreciate the opportunity to talk today. As you can see from the title, I'm going to be focusing primarily on aquatic ecosystems. It goes without saying that the myriad of uses of nanomaterials, both intentional and maybe unintentional, result in significant amounts of these materials getting into the environment. And when they get into the environment, and that undoubtedly they're going to find their way to aquatic ecosystems. So if you move to slide two, I've got an outline for today's talk, and I'm going to begin by addressing some of the challenges of working with these materials in aquatic ecosystems and explain a little bit about carbon nanoparticles in particular, because those are the compound or the particles that we've been working with. And then talk about some of our research that deals with the interactions of these particles in aquatic ecosystems, primarily surface modification to stabilize suspensions in aquatic ecosystems, and then talk about natural organic matter, which is sort of the way nature does this. And in both cases, I'll talk about implications for aquatic toxicology. Move on to slide three. Some of the challenges of working in aquatic ecosystems deal primarily with characterizing nanoparticle behavior. How these particles behave in a aqueous suspension may very well dictate their interactions with aquatic organisms. And in order to develop quantitative relationships between these nanoparticle suspensions and aquatic organisms, we really need to be able to have a well-characterized nanoparticle suspension. I think it's been one of the challenges in previous research in this area. The second area dwells with nanoparticle organism interactions. And this again goes to characterizing not only the particles but also their surface chemistry. Particle size, particle shape, as well as surface chemistry all influence significantly the interactions of their interactions with organisms. And finally, once these organisms interact with these particles, they may very well take them up. These particles are of a size range that can pass through membranes. So it's very likely that these may pass into organisms. And so their fate within an organism as well as the potential mode of action is extremely important to characterize. Today I'm going to dwell primarily on the first two. These are obviously important to characterize before we can move on to things like characterizing modes of action. Slide four, aquatic toxicologists have historically dealt with compounds and contaminants that are true solutes. And I think that one of the challenges is that we as aquatic toxicologists haven't dealt with too many particles. In fact, the primary literature source for dealing with particles in aquatic systems really comes from research dealing with colloids. Some of the work that has been reported, though, on behavior of nanoparticles in aquatic ecosystems illustrates very, very vividly, as you see in the picture of the photomicrograph on the left by Brand et al. In 2007, that these materials can aggregate over time in the suspension. This dynamic change in particle size is extremely important, and we need to be able to characterize that if we're going to be able to quantitatively assess exposures. How these particles interact with aquatic organisms may very well influence their stability in suspensions, as illustrated in that middle photomicrograph is Daphnia magna, water flea, interacting with single wall carbon nanotubes, and you can see that the organism has destabilized the suspension and caused it to precipitate, and actually these aggregates are actually adhering to the daphnid. And further to the right now, as also shown by Brand et al., we're not ever dealing with a single particle size when we're dealing with these suspensions. In most cases, probably in all cases in natural systems, we're going to deal with particle size distributions. These distributions can change, and it's probably it's important to not only characterize the size distribution, but also how that distribution changes during exposure scenarios. Go to slide five. And I mentioned that a significant amount of work had been done in colloids, and a lot of that work in the literature demonstrates, as does this work with Christakis et al. In 1998, that aquatic organisms discriminate between particles of different sizes. Using a marine ciliate, they looked at clearance rates of different particles particle sizes, excuse me, and looked at their efficiency at clearing these things, these particles from solution. And you can see that the clearance rate was heavily dependent on the diameter of the of these microspheres that they were dealing with. While these are in the micron, just barely sub-micron range, you can. It's not too difficult to imagine that particle interaction or with organism interaction with nanoparticles could be quite different than the ones with micron-sized particles. So it's going to be very important to ascertain how particle size influences the interactions with aquatic organisms. Moving on to slide six, I mentioned earlier that organisms themselves can modify the nanoparticles in the aquatic ecosystem. Work that Roberts et al. Published in 2007 demonstrated that very rapidly, at least within 48 hours, this water flea, this Daphnia magna, basically destabilized these stable suspensions and result in significant amounts of the nanoparticles, single wall nanotubes, coming out of suspension and aggregating and precipitating from the solution. Moving on to slide seven. I'd like to talk a little bit about carbon nanoparticles, and I imagine that those of you that have been involved in the rest of these seminars are familiar with some of these, but just briefly I'd like to review some of the carbon nanoparticles. The smallest of some of these nanoparticles, quantum dots, carbon quantum dots, have recently been made. These are solid quantum dots. Sun et al. In 2006 began producing these. The more familiar fullerenes, C60 and C70, the Bucky ball and the Bucky soccer ball, if you will, Bucky rugby ball, if you will, are illustrated there. And then the single wall nanotubes that should be pretty familiar with most folks are illustrated on the bottom of that slide. On slide eight, you see multi-wall nanotubes, which are several concentric single-wall tubes, as well as photomicrographs of nanocoils and nanowires, all of which have very different applications and have begun to be used in industries. We've actually looked at most of these carbon materials in our research. In order to look at them, though, in aquatic systems, these very hydrophobic compounds or these very hydrophobic particles have to usually have some surface modification in order to allow them to interact with water molecules and stabilize the particles in suspension. There are various ways of doing it. You can covalently modify these by the simplest way might be just acid treating them, which hydroxylates the external carbons on the carbon nanomaterials and allows them to then participate in hydrogen bonding with the water molecules, which stabilizes the suspensions. Some of the work that my physicist colleagues have been doing has been doing non-covalent bonding or modification of the surfaces. And here illustrates some slide nine illustrates some couple methods of doing this. The first with C60, and it turns out that if you put C60 into water with lysophospholipid, which is a classic phospholipid that has one of the tails removed. So in this case, it's phosphatidylcholine with one of the fatty acid tails removed. The tail wraps around the C60, and the polar head group sticks out into the media, allowing it to interact with the water molecules. C70 took a little bit different kind of approach with C70. They used gallic acid, shown there to the right of the C70 molecule. And in this case, you notice that nice six-membered ring fits very nicely on the six-membered rings of the C70. And that pi stacking allows that carboxylic acid and the OH groups to stick out into the aqueous suspension or aqueous solution, the media, and interact with the water molecules and also stabilize the suspension of C70. One of the interesting things about the C70 gallic acid complex is that it has a nice bright green fluorescence. If you move to slide 10, you see what happens when you put Daphnia magna into this C70 gallic acid suspension for, in this case, about 30 minutes. This confocal photomicrograph illustrates that the C70 gallic acid seems to adhere to the surface of the Daphnia. I don't have any toxicity data in this slide presentation. We have characterized some effects, but what was more interesting is this apparent uniform coverage of the Daphnia and its and the bright green fluorescence that resulted. This may have some utility in photomicroscopy. Slide 11 illustrates our approach to surface modifying the single wall nanotubes. In this case, we go back to the lysophospholipid, and this non-covalent method, basically, the lysophospholipids self-assemble with the single wall nanotube. The fatty acid tails align on the single wall nanotube, and the polar head sticks out into the aquatic medium. This happens quite readily with a little bit of input of some energy, usually via sonication, and the suspension becomes quite stable. If you move to slide 12, see a photomicrograph of a system that of a solution that we've composed with both the single wall nanotubes and the phospholipids. A is a single wall nanotube by itself. B is a bundle of tubes that both of which of these are not modified. The phospholipid-coated single-wall nanotubes are shown in C, sort of in the upper part of the photomicrograph, and excess phospholipids are in D. These become quite stable in suspension and facilitate uses in aquatic medium. If you then expose a Daphnia magna to this suspension, the results are seen in slide 13. And for those of you that aren't familiar with Daphnia magna, this water flea shown up in the upper left-hand, a control is shown in the upper left-hand picture on slide 13. It's a filter feeder. It basically is very efficient at putting everything in the water column into its mouth. And in this particular case, you see the intestinal tract glowing bright green. That's because it's been eating a lot of algae. However, in the presence of nanoparticles, as you might suspect, all the nanoparticles get into the gut. Across the bottom, you see the control on the left. The next picture at 45 minutes shows some single wall nanotubes beginning to accumulate in the gut. At 1 hour, you see the gut completely full of single wall nanotubes, and by 20 hours, the Daphnia magna have basically stripped the phospholipid from the tube. The tubes have precipitated, and they've egested the tubes back out into the environment, and they have precipitated, and in fact precipitated and stuck onto the daphnids. In this case, the primary stressor is actually a physical stress, both in clogging the intestinal tract as well as adhering to the surface of the daphnia. You see a dose response in the graph on the upper right on this slide, illustrating a significant effect at 10 milligrams per liter on survival of this organism. Moving on to slide 14, I'd like to leave the artificially modified carbon nanoparticles and move into sort of nature's way of stabilizing these particles in aquatic ecosystems. And that's through natural organic matter. For those of you who aren't familiar with natural organic matter, it's a complex mixture of the decay products from plants in the watershed. These organics wash into surface waters, and it's the classic brown tea-like color that you see in many surface streams. Slide 15 discusses natural organic matter a little bit more information. The most important thing here is that there are both hydrophobic as well as hydrophilic regions in natural organic matter. And so many researchers, including ourselves, have characterized their interactions with contaminants, including metals and pesticides, and actually shown that natural organic matter significantly influences the bioavailability of contaminants to aquatic organisms. Slide 16 shows some work by Terashima and Nagao in 2007 that demonstrated that natural organic matter, a little bit of natural organic matter, stabilized fullerenes, a suspension of fullerenes. Slide 17 shows some work published this spring, or this past January, by Huang et al., in which they looked at Suwannee River natural organic matter and its interaction with multi-wall nanotubes. You see, going across the, this is a very nice visual demonstration of how natural organic matter stabilizes these suspensions. And I draw your attention to C, which is the Suwannee River NOM solution. And it's a very stable. I think this they allowed these to stay to settle for 4 days. They still were in suspension. At the same time, we had begun looking at natural organic matter and its interaction with some of the carbon nanomaterials that we had been interested in. And some of these results are shown on 18, on slide 18. And we took the same approach that the folks at Huang et al. Had taken. And looking at 100 milligrams per liter of natural organic matter and 400 milligrams per liter of the nanoparticles, sonicated for 30 minutes. And we looked at a variety of nanoparticles, everywhere from the fullerenes to the nanotubes to the nanocoils and the wires. Those test tubes across in the picture, A is water, and B is NOM without any nanoparticles. But and by the way, we used as did the previous researchers, we used the Suwannee River standardized NOM, natural organic matter, that you can get from the International Humic Substances Society. Tube C in this picture shows C60. Notice the light color there. It wasn't quite as stable as some of the others. And that light color illustrates that some of it had precipitated out over 4 days. D is the C70, and it was very stable. E is one that caught my fancy because this is single-wall nanotubes. And what's happening in all these cases is that the natural organic matter is adsorbing onto the surface of the of the carbon nanoparticle modifying the surface and usually resulting in better interaction with the water molecules. In the case of single wall nanotubes, not only did it cause it to precipitate, but all the natural organic matter was taken out of the suspension, out of the solution. So we haven't been able to follow up on this, but it is a line of research that we intend to look at more closely. F is the multi-wall nanotubes, basically repeating the work of Huang, and G and H are the nanocoils and the nanowires. Now the question is, were these stable suspensions bioavailable? And on the next slide, you see, on slide 19, you see just very quick toxicity work. We wanted to know whether these materials were bioavailable. And this was sort of a quick and dirty bioassay in which we didn't get a lot of toxicity. However, we realized that we were dealing with nominal concentrations, and it wasn't apparent that what we were producing was actually reproducible. So in order to, as I stated earlier, and if you move to slide 20, you'll see a standard operating procedure for producing standard reproducible nanoparticle suspensions. And we developed this because in order to quantify the relationship between exposure and response with an aquatic organism, the exposure scenario has to be consistent and characterized. One of the ways that we traditionally approach looking at contaminants whose concentration varies with time, and in a soluble contaminant it might be one that's volatile, for example, is that we look at a static renewal bioassay. In this case, the organism is basically transferred to fresh contaminant media every 24 hours. And so what we've done here is, and we have a very detailed standard operating procedure, but in brief on this slide, shows you it basically shows that we took 25 milligrams per liter of the carbon nanoparticle and suspended them using sonication in water containing 15 milligrams per liter of dissolved organic carbon. And by the way, you don't have to use the natural organic matter from the International Humic Substances Society. We actually extract and characterize our own, and so you'll see some further data on that. But with all the natural organic matter sources, we use this standard operating procedure. If you let the suspension settle for 24 hours, you then can quantify what has precipitated. So you get a beginning concentration of 25 milligrams per liter, and you get an ending concentration of what you measure that is precipitated. And by difference, you know what the suspended concentration was after 24 hours. We've now I show you that the ending concentration is around 18 milligrams per liter after 24 hours, and I have N at 12 and the coefficient of variation there. We've done this far more than 12 times now, and we get very good reproducibility, and so we're fairly confident that we actually know what the organisms are exposed to, at least concentration wise. Using this approach, we characterized the toxicity of these materials. And if you move the chart to 21, slide 21, we'll focus on the multi-wall nanotubes. The rest of this work will be with multi-wall nanotubes. And you notice that if we look at the acute toxicity, 96-hour LC50s of multi-wall nanotubes to Daphnia magna, you notice that the LC50 value changes with the different sources of natural organic matter. We are in the process of characterizing the natural organic matters for their various degrees of aromaticity, other functional groups, and other characteristics of the natural organic matter to see if we can explain some of these differences in the LC50s. Moving to slide 22, you see that if we use Suwannee River only, and we use different concentrations of natural organic matter to stabilize the multi-wall nanotubes, you see the LC50s don't change. Our theory here, and we're in the process of looking at lower concentrations of natural organic matter, but our theory here is that there's a finite surface area on these multi-wall nanotubes, and that surface is covered pretty readily. And so the concentrations of 10, 15, and 18 milligrams per liter of carbon of the natural organic matter probably represent complete surface coverage, and so you don't get any more benefit from additional amounts of natural organic matter. So the real interesting results may be coming soon as we finish up our work with 7, 5, and 3 milligrams per liter of carbon. Slide 23, my former postdoc, Aaron Roberts, who's now at University of North Texas, also has been working and continuing to collaborate on this work, and they've been looking at the growth of Daphnia magna exposed to multi-wall nanotubes suspended in 10 milligrams per liter of Suwannee River natural organic matter. And you see a nice dose response relationship where the higher the concentration of multi-wall nanotubes, the lower the weight gain in the Daphnia magna over 96 hours. So we're beginning to see some sublethal responses to these exposures. Slide 24 looks at a different water column invertebrate, a Ceridaphnia dubia, and another filter feeder. And you see that Ceridaphnia dubia reproduction was significantly reduced in the sub-milligram per liter range of multi-wall nanotubes, again stabilized in Suwannee River natural organic matter. So again, some sublethal responses, and this obviously has implications for population level effects if you're impacting reproduction. Slide 25, in conclusion, I want to reiterate the real need to characterize these particles, and we are continuing to further characterize the particles we've been working with in these suspensions. Simple measurements like dynamic light scattering can give you particle size distributions. Photomicrographs can get you shapes, aggregates. These are going to be very important for explaining some of the results that you get with toxicity data. As far as our research goes, it appears that that natural organic matter is readily stabilizes most carbon nanoparticles, with the exception of the single wall nanotubes. The source appears to be more important. The source of natural organic matter appears to play a larger influence on multi-wall nanotube bioavailability than does the concentration. And I bring your attention to slide 26, which lists all my collaborators, particularly my PhD students who have done the predominant amount of this research, as well as my other collaborators. And I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge the National Science Foundation for funding. And slide 27 is the literature that I've cited throughout the presentation and some other literature as well. And I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Klaney. We'll begin with the questions in just one second. I'd like to mention one thing I forgot to mention earlier. Those of you connecting by phone, please do not place the conference on hold. You might have music or other distractions which could be broadcast into the seminar. If that happens, we would disconnect your line. If you get disconnected for that reason or for any other reason, you can dial back into the seminar using the same numbers. Okay, let's start with the question and answer period. Those of you who are connected on the phones, if you have a question for Dr. Klaney, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization.
Hi, Dr. Klaney. This is Al Kennedy, Engineer Research and Development Center. Do you have any idea if the sonication of the nanotubes is breaking them and adding to their stabilization in the organic matter, or do you think the aspect ratio of the tubes has not changed?
I don't know about the tubes. I will tell you that if you sonicate fullerenes, you will hydroxylate the surface. And so we try to minimize the amount of sonication that we use. We have gotten, you know, obviously not quite as great as dispersal, but if you simply stir them for a longer period of time, you do get this interaction with the natural organic matter. And although it's not quite as efficient as the sonication, we haven't seen tube deterioration with the sonication, at least in the photomicrographs that we've looked at, the EM work that we've done. But it is something that we're continuing to try to characterize.
This is Warren Lane from Region 5. And I just had a question about the reproducibility from batch to batch of the size of the nanotubes, and also if you could speculate on why single-walled nanotubes act so differently from the rest of them.
Well, okay, let's see. The first question was reproducibility of the size, and we've got some dynamic light scattering data that suggests that the distributions of sizes is relatively consistent. And that's particularly with the lysophospholipid modified single wall nanotubes. We're in the midst of, in fact, we'll be on the dynamic light scattering instrument tomorrow, looking at these multi-wall tubes and natural organic matter, trying to characterize those sizes. Let's see, the second question was why single wall nanotubes act differently. And, you know, I personally don't have a clue. But the physicists in our group suggest that that the single wall nanotubes flex differently, and this is on a molecular scale, flex differently than the multi-wall tubes, and that their interactions with natural organic matter may be different. We're endeavoring to try to characterize that, and we haven't gotten very far down that line. To me, it's pretty fascinating. It's almost like you could throw some single-wall nanotubes into a solution and take out all the organic carbon, which actually may have some use. But I really don't know any more than that, and that's pure speculation.
This is one more question. You seem to be concentrating on concentration as one of the main factors when you're looking at your parameters. But there's a lot of evidence in the literature to suggest that concentration has nothing to do with the case, that it's surface area that is a factor. Have you looked at anything related to surface area?
Well, the sort of brute force approach of doing the gravimetric work got us at least milligrams per liter, and so that was the one that we could get to pretty readily. I agree with your comment about surface area, and the other way, of course, to look at concentration would be milligrams, area, surface area per milliliter or per liter. And as we get better measurements on the surface area of these particles, we will in fact look at the relationships, so that the exposure response relationships as a function of surface area, and see if it changes our interpretation of the data. We're also trying to look at surface chemistry to see if that is changing in the system. So, but we haven't gotten to either. We haven't been able to get enough data on either of those at this point for me to make some conclusions.
Okay, I appreciate your answers very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the question.
Okay, I'd like to read a question submitted by one of our simulcast participants. This is from Martin Griffin, Wisconsin DNR in Madison. Even though natural organic matter with different types of carbon nanomaterials appear to not be bioavailable since mortality is low, this analysis is for adult Daphnia. Have you looked at reproductive success or how the suspended nanomaterials affect Daphnia behaviors in other ways? For example, coating equals increased molting, equals more vulnerable to predation, equals high mortality.
Okay.
Let me know if you need me to repeat that. I know that was a little difficult.
No, I think I understand. I refer you back to the last two slides, the two data slides. That'd be slides 23 and 24. You will note that that those multi-wall tubes were suspended in natural organic matter, and so you do see some effects. And the one I'd like to point out, at least very vividly in slide 24, is that reproduction decreases significantly in fairly low concentrations, 250 micrograms per liter. So, and this is in a standard 7-day static renewal Serra Daphnia dubia bioassay, same kinds of bioassays that we use for National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System effluent characterizations. I wouldn't go out on a limb and say that these things are less available in the presence of natural organic matter. I know that one slide showed some very preliminary data, and I sort of couched that in the fact that we really didn't have a good idea of the actual concentrations, that those were nominals, and that that was a 96-hour test in which we didn't renew the solutions. And so it was really a quick and dirty test, and that stimulated us, though, to go on and develop a more quantitative way of keeping a consistent exposure and better quantifying the relationship between concentration and response. As you can see, we've moved out of lethality and into sublethal responses, and we are showing that these multi-wall nanotubes in fairly low concentrations are influencing reproduction. And I think that answers the question. If not, please let me know, and I'll try again.
Thank you. So, Martin, I know you're still listening. If you need more explanation there, Dr. Claney just invited you to email him, and he will follow up further. Let me continue on with another question from another simulcast participant. This is from Lisa McIntosh at Woodard and Curran in Dedham, Massachusetts. Lisa asks, your slides show that natural organic matter appears to influence bioavailability / toxicity. Could this be, at least in part, attributed to the presence of other constituents, such as free metals, etc.?
Maybe. That's a good question. In our trying to think back to the characterization of the Suwannee River natural organic matter. But in the natural organic matters, the one from the Edisto and the one from the Black, that we actually concentrated and characterized ourselves. We actually checked for metal, and there's not very much metal in there, including iron. There's not much iron in there either. Part of that was the fact that in the part of the concentration step for natural organic matters, you run it through some ion exchange columns, and you get rid of the metals. The reason you need to do that, of course, is to get rid of some of the calcium and the magnesium, which can cross-link and cause precipitation of the natural organic matter. So in the process, you also get rid of many of the divalent cations and the metals. In natural systems, there's two different things going on between metals and nanotubes. The metals are binding to ligands, OH groups, carboxylic acids, nitrogen groups on the natural organic matter. The organic portion of the natural organic matter is actually adsorbing onto the carbon nanoparticle. And so I'm not sure these two processes are competitive or would even interfere with each other. However, I would agree that in the presence of metals, you probably then end up having a carbon nanoparticle that has both natural organic matter that's adsorbed onto the surface, and also the natural organic matter has metals bound to it. Although we've shown in our previous research, as have many other researchers, that metals bound to natural organic matter are significantly reduced in terms of their bioavailability.
Thank you.
Let's
check back with our phone participants. Go right ahead.
I have a question.
Yes? Go right ahead.
All right, this is Mark Chappell from the Army Corps of Engineers. With the surfactant that you used to surface modify the carbon nanotubes.
Yes.
Did you test? You said you suspended these, or you mixed the nanotubes with the surfactant, and you got a stable dispersion. Is that correct?
Correct.
Did you test? At what concentrations did you add the surfactant? Did you test below the CMC and above the CMC? And what exactly is the CMC for this surfactant?
Oh, good question. And I apologize for not having that information in front of me. I'll tell you that the ratio, we looked at several different ratios on a molar basis of lysophospholipid and single wall nanotubes. And the best results occurred at about 6-1 lysophospholipid to single wall nanotube. I have to go look up what the CMC is, and I apologize for not having that information. Although we did, and when we did test, obviously we did the toxicity of the lysophospholipid by itself, and it showed no toxicity. And in fact, our data, and it's in that paper we published in Environmental Science and Technology in April, Roberts et al., but it actually shows that the daphnids were actually using the lysophospholipid as a food source.
Okay, and can you tell me, did you only use the lysophospholipid, or did you try other surfactants when you did this?
We have tried surfactants, and there's a paper, and I think it's in the literature cited by Key et al., I think, that actually looked at the stability of the lysophospholipid modified single wall nanotube as compared to other surfactants stabilizing the lysophospholipids, stabilizing the single wall nanotubes. And the lysophospholipid worked better. But we haven't tested the toxicity of other surfactant stabilized single wall nanotube suspensions.
Okay.
We'll stay with the phone participants. If you have a question, please introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, while they're thinking, I've got another question submitted by Martin Griffin from Wisconsin DNR in Madison. Has anyone looked at other types of filter feeders, for example, bivalves, since they can filter higher volumes of water and thus lower concentrations may have a larger effect?
I actually know, I believe, I know of colleagues that are looking at bivalves. There are other cladocerins that have been used, I think some estuarine species have been used. Primarily, most of the work that has been done with water column organisms and freshwater systems have been done with daphnids such as Daphnia magna and Ceridaphnia dubia, for the obvious reasons of the fact that they're filter feeders. The bivalve issue is pretty interesting and really gets close to something that I almost be neglect without sort of talking about a little bit, and that would be that even though these things are in the water column and semi-stabilized with natural organic matter, they are still particles. They're not solutes. And so sooner or later they're going to fall out. They're going to end up on a surface. And so benthic organisms are really, really important to work with. And we're moving in that direction also. But there are groups that are looking at bivalves. There are groups that are looking at benthic invertebrates. And I think that those are going to be very important studies because I think ultimately all of these nanoparticles are going to end up on surfaces.
Okay, there's a follow-up from Martin Griffin here, and you may have started touching on this, but his follow-up is, the photos of carbon nanomaterials accumulated in the gut of Daphnia was impressive. Has anyone looked at the possibility of bioaccumulation in various species, being one being larger than another, like, for instance, Daphnia greater than bivalves, greater than otters, greater than fish, or something like that? Any tie-in to more species?
No. There's been very limited work in terms of bioaccumulation. And we are beginning a series of research lines that really deal with not only bioaccumulation, but also transfer through the food chain. So, what we show here is accumulation or really bioconcentration in the gut. And we also show, as was in that last slide of our last picture in that series of four with the daphnids, that they egest it. So they get rid of it out of their gut. They clear their gut tract. So we do have some limited data that seems to suggest that these things may be moving to other parts of the organism, but that's very limited data. We are very interested though in looking at what happens when a fish eats these daphnids that have accumulated these nanoparticles. We're also working with some algae and some biofilms too in that regard. So, this whole area has not been explored very much, and I think one of the reasons has been until you can adequately characterize the behavior of these particles, it's very difficult to jump into doing a lot of biological testing because you don't have a good handle on your exposure scenarios, and that's why we're trying to proceed in a fairly cautious manner. And really focusing on trying to characterize these suspensions more than just simply cranking out, accumulation numbers and concentration numbers and toxicity data.
Okay, let's check back to our phone participant. Do you have a question?
Can I have a question?
Go right ahead.
I'm Katrina Gonzalo from Engineer Research and Development Center, and I have more of a comment than a question, but the question was raised about effect of metals removal on inorganic matter on their interaction with nanoparticles. And from my personal experience, removal of metals can not only increase sorption of something that would be sorbing through the ligands, it can also decrease sorption of something that sorbs to the neutral parts of the organic matter, because it seems that metal there sort of serve as a shield, which shields the charge.
I wouldn't doubt it. I don't have any data, but I trust yours. We haven't really begun to work with, you know, multiple contaminants in these systems. We've done a little bit of work with copper and single wall nanotubes, but we haven't really looked at any of these multiple contaminants in the presence of natural organic matter.
Thank you.
Dr. Craney, this is Chuck Maurice in Region 5, and I was wondering, I suspect you don't know the answer to this, but what your gut feeling tells you from what you've seen and the studies that you've conducted, do you get the idea that these nanoparticles are passing through the guts of the Daphnia and the Theriodaphnia without incorporation into the organism, that is, it's just passing through? The Daphnia are consuming the nanoparticles, and then it gets into their gut, and then they're passing it out back into the environment again. Or do you think that there's some portion of it that is actually being absorbed through the gut into the organism?
All right, well, I'll go out on a limb, and I'm just going to give you some very, very preliminary data.
Yeah, I would just be expecting you to be speculating at this point,
yeah,
because I don't think anyone knows the answer, but I just would like to get a feel for.
Well, we've got photomicrographs of, and they're confocal images that seem to suggest that there are some nanoparticles in other parts of the organism, some nanoparticle clumps. However, I'm not convinced at this point, because they could be just underneath the carapace. In other words, it could be a clump that basically was egested and then somehow got underneath the carapace, underneath some of the appendages, and just appears that it might be in the cavity of the daphnid. The other piece of data that we have that somewhat suggested is that the C70 gallic acid exposures, we've seen some evidence of apoptosis in the intestinal tract. So there seems to be some interaction with cells in the intestinal tract. Now, I don't know if that's a physical or a chemical response at this point, but we have seen those kinds of interactions. To be perfectly honest, in a very, very naive manner, when we got into this, I said, gosh, wouldn't this be nice if we could get, we could work with daphnids, and they're so clear that we'd be able to see particle movement, and interestingly, maybe we could see particle movement into the eggs. Well, we haven't even come close to seeing anything like that. And so the data are still suggestive that the organisms aren't taking it in. At this point, basically the majority of the interaction is occurring on the surface, the carapace, and in the intestinal tract.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Okay, I think it's about time we move on to our second speaker. Let me just remind those of you who have submitted questions over the internet. I will forward those to Dr. Claney. Hopefully we can prevail on him to answer those questions with response back by email. If you're on the phone and you have additional questions, please hang around till the end of the seminar, and we'll have an additional question and answer period. We hope to have a few minutes reserved at the end to ask additional questions of Dr. Claney. And also, I would note that his email address is available on the seminar webpage. And you can submit questions to him by email. Please make sure to reference today's web seminar. Okay, I'd like to go back to Chuck Maurice, who will introduce today's second speaker. Chuck?
Okay, thank you, Larry. Our second speaker today is Dr. Patrick Larkin. He's the independent ecotoxicology consultant, as well as being affiliated with the Santa Fe Community College. Dr. Larkin was a Superfund basic research program trainee at the University of Florida, where he received his PhD in the Department of Neuroscience. During his tenure as a postdoctoral associate at the University of Florida, he developed and validated gene chips, microarrays, in largemouth bass, sheephead minnows, and blue crabs. The title of his talk today is Screening of the Nanoparticle Using In Vivo and Microarray Studies. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Larkin.
I want to thank you, Chuck, and NIH for this opportunity to talk today. I'm going to skip on to slide number 29, since you've already read my title. So I first want to thank my participants, my collaborators, Ava Oberoester, she's from Duke University, as well as David Rajewski and Andrew Maynard from the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Dave Rajewski is actually going to give a presentation next month through this program. This study was funded by the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars. The Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies was created in partnership with the Pew Charitable Trust Foundation. Slide number 30. So the reference that I'm going to talk about today is shown on slide 30. This report can be found at the below URL. I could also send the URL to Larry after this talk if anyone wants to access this article.
Dr. Larkin, I'll make sure and add this URL to the additional resources for this seminar, so it'll be there for folks to access that way.
Hey, Clark. All right, so slide 31, this is the outline of my talk. First, I'm going to go through the background of my project with Ava. First, talk about the Daphne studies, where Ava conducted some exposures. Then I'll go through the results. Then I'll go through the fathead minnow studies that we did, talk about the exposure studies, and then the results. Then I'm going to take a few minutes and go through talk about microarrays. Many of you are probably toxicologists, but may not be as familiar with microarray technology. Then I'm going to go through the array results and then the conclusions. Slide number 32. So there's a lot of interest in the nanoparticle field in general. There's a seminar series that many of you are attending. This morning I actually did a PubMed search just typing in the term nanoparticles in PubMed at NCBI. I found over 11,906 articles that contain this term. Now, of these articles, about 6,178 articles were published in 2006 and 2007. The majority of the articles were published recently. Now, contrast that with only about 189 articles that were published in 2000. So there's a tremendous amount of interest in this field. Now, because so many nanoparticles are being used today in the marketplace, this really requires new methods to assess both short and long-term potential environmental impacts of these compounds. Slide number 33. So for this study, to test the nanoparticles, what Abe and I did was we used a standard EPA-approved ecotoxicology test using Daphnia with assays using a newly developed 2,000-gene microarray for the fathead minnow. Now, this study is the first study that I know of to use both traditional in vivo assays in fathead minnows as well as new tools like microarrays to examine the toxicity of a particular nanoparticle. Slide number 34. So for this study, Ava and I collaborated directly with a company, Coda America, that manufactures reactive nano iron particles, or RNIP. These particles are currently being used to remediate a number of different toxic waste sites, both in the United States as well as abroad. Slide number 35. For the study, Toda graciously donated about a kilogram of material that we use for toxicity testing. This material is in a slurry. You can see on the bottom left of this slide a picture of the slurry. On the bottom right, the ingredients are listed. You guys could read them for yourselves. Now, one property that characterizes these particular nanoparticles from their microscale counterparts is a very large reactive surface area with over 9,000 square feet per ounce of material. Now, the ability of iron to rust or oxidize gives these nanoparticles the ability to treat hazardous substances and chemicals. The particles can be injected directly into groundwater or used to detoxify contaminated water in above-ground tanks. RNIPS have also been shown to be very effective in treating specific compounds, including chlorinated organic solvents, organochlorine pesticides, and polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs. Slide number 36. These studies were conducted by AVA, the Daphne exposure studies. AVA's the toxicologist of the group. Unfortunately, she couldn't make it to today's seminar, so I'll do the best at the end to field the questions you have about the exposures. Now, for the study, AVA initially used water fleas, Daphne and Magna, to examine the toxicity of RNIP. As you guys are all probably well aware, Daphne are small crustaceans that live in various freshwater sites, such as ponds and lakes. Daphne are an important source of food for a variety of fish, as well as other aquatic organisms. Like the fathead minnow, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, Daphne are commonly used as a bioindicator species by various governmental agencies, including the U.S. EPA, as well as USGS and others. Slide number 37. Now, another advantage of using Daphne for toxicity center studies in general, and this one in particular, is that, as you guys are probably well aware, the species is fairly easily grown and maintained in a laboratory setting. And just shown on slide 37 is just a beaker showing the Daphne. Slide number 38 illustrates the Daphne range finding studies that were conducted. The figure shows mortality after exposures of Daphne to a variety of concentrations of RNIPS. And you might have to look carefully at this slide. AVA used exposures ranging from about 30 mg per liter. Those are the paint-colored lines on the graph, all the way up to about 2,500 mg per liter. So the based on the exposure studies that we did, the 48-hour LC50 for RNIP was found to be approximately 55 parts per million. And in comparison, this is approximately the same as that for bulk iron. Now, based on, if you turn to slide number 39, based on a toxicity rating scale, RNIP would be considered slightly toxic. Now, I just want to first mention, I was looking at my slides this morning, and the table that you see here is actually, I copied the wrong one in this presentation. I apologize for that. The correct table that we use is found in the article that Larry will provide a link for. And there's a reference at the bottom of the slide for the that I used to derive the table that's in the article. So one point, so we found RNIP is considered based on the table, it's considered slightly toxic. Now, one point that's worth mentioning is that about 55 ppm of RNIP is a very high dose, and this would likely not be seen at watershed sites after remediation is completed. Now, for comparison purposes, chemicals such as benzoylpyrene have an LC50 that's less than 0.1 ppm, and benzoylpyrene is considered to be very highly toxic. Slide number 40, if you could turn to that one. Now, one interesting observation that AVA found, and this was really expanded upon in the first presentation by Dr. Claney, is that the RNIPS actually coat various structures of the Daphne. So we found that Daphne ingested RNIP, and this nanoparticle actually coated the carapace, including the filtering apparatus and various appendages. So this figure that you're looking at on for slide 40, it shows different Daphne after exposed to different concentrations of RNIPS. So from A to F, A is controlled apnea. B, animals were exposed to 3 mg per liter of RNIP. Picture C is 7.5 mg per liter. D is animals exposed to 15 mg per liter. E is 30, and F is 125 mg per liter, which actually this was a dead daphnid. And one point worth mentioning is that all daphnids are 21 days old, and egg pouches are visible, or eggs are visible in their brood pouches. One thing I want to point your attention to on this figure is the darkening of the digestive tract. So look at A all the way up to F. Normal daphnids are greenish in color on their digestive tract, but you can see increasing amount of RNIPs in their digestive tract moving from A to D. Antenna also became clogged with this nano iron particle. This could be seen by the dashed arrows in E and F. Now, even though the daphnids were coated with RNIP, it's worth mentioning that they still were able to survive, and they're able to feed and reproduce over a 21-day life cycle test. Now, the significance of the coating of the daphnids is currently unknown. One thing would be to look further, do further life cycle tests. All right, so if you move to slide number 41, I want to now change gears a little bit and talk about the fathead minnow exposure studies. The fathead minnow exposures were also conducted by AVA. Fathead minnows, the reason we chose fathead minnows as a species for the toxicity test, reasons are listed below. As you guys are well aware, fathead minnows are a standard test species that have been used in aquatic toxicology since the 1960s, and these organisms are used widely in ecotoxicology. For example, there's over about 9,000 records for fathead minnows in the ecotox database alone. Another reason we chose fathead minnows is that their reproductive physiology is very well known. These fish can also be very easily propagated in the laboratory. If you turn now to slide number 42, this slide goes over the fathead minnow exposures. Now we based our fathead minnow exposure design on two things. One was the Daphnia range finding study that I talked about a few minutes ago. I also based the exposures on a study that I did in sheephead minnows. I could send Larry this article if anyone's interested. Now, in the sheephead minnow study, it's published in EHP, Toxicogenomics. I examined gene expression profiles in sheephead minnows that were exposed to 4 or 5 days to a number of different compounds that mimic estrogens. These included methoxychlor, DES, nonylphenol. So we chose a fairly short-term exposure for this study, 5 days. And we used a dose of RNIP that was 50 ppm. Now, just one thing worth mentioning is that this was a first study of its kind, so we sort of had to just lay some groundwork of the length of exposures. But a lot of follow-up studies could be conducted to look at different concentrations, longer-term exposures, more acute exposures as well. Now, for the fathead minnow exposures, each tank contained 3 male adult fathead minnows, and if you look at the figure, you'll note that the tanks that had RNIP had a fairly dark color to the water. That would be the aquaria to the right in that picture. Now, fish were exposed as groups of 3 in 10-liter aquaria with 5 different aquaria serving as controls and 5 different aquaria containing RNIP. We used a total of 30 fish for the array study. Now, another point about the exposures was that AVA did a 50% water change at both 24 and 72 hours, and both water quality and temperature were monitored at all times, and they were found to be in normal ranges. Now, at the end of the exposures, what Ava found was that the concentration of RNIPS, 50 parts per million, that was used did not cause any overt physical changes, such as lesions or mortality in the fish. If you turn now to slide 43, slide 43 just shows an overview of microarray technology or gene array technology on how it works. So after the exposures, Ava sacrificed the animals, dissected out various tissues, froze those in liquid nitrogen, and shipped me the samples. Once I received the samples, messenger RNA was extracted. The messenger RNA was for the two tissues that we examined, gill and liver, were labeled with a fluorescent label, hybridized onto the microarrays. After hybridizations and washing, the microarrays were scanned, and then using various bioinformatics programs, I analyzed the data. For the study, I used 20 microarrays for the experiments to examine gene expression patterns in both liver tissue and also gill tissue of male fathead minnows. For the design, I used 5 control arrays and 5 treated arrays were run for each of the tissues, both gill and liver. So on slide 44, this is a picture of one of the 20 microarrays that were run. These arrays were actually designed using the Agilent's microarray platform, which I'll talk about on the next slide, which is number 45. Now, slide number 45 shows a cartoon of how, a simplistic cartoon of how microarrays work. For the study, let me go over first the pictures. So we designed probes, 60 MER probes, for approximately 2,000 genes. So the messenger RNA samples are labeled and then hybridized to the chips. For the design, we used a reference design where a common sample was labeled and applied to all the chips. So the same reference sample was used for all the chips. The reason for that was for normalization purposes. Now, one other point worth mentioning is that the 60 MER probes that I used were designed by Agilent. These probes are synthesized in situ, meaning that they're made on the chips themselves. This is a little bit different technology than other arrays from other customer arrays where you could synthesize the probes and spot them onto the glass surface. Okay, so turning now to slide number 46. One thing I just want to make everyone aware of is that Agilent, I don't work for Agilent or anything, Agilent has an e-array design platform. They offer custom array design and printing, and this what this allows researchers to do is create your own microarray designs for a specific need. And this is a nice technology, so any researcher, say, that's interested in fathead minnows or other species that has sequences can upload those, design your own probes, and make your own arrays. So you could make arrays, and the importance of this I'll illustrate in a few minutes. Now, at least in fathead minnows, custom array design is now at the fingertips available to a lot of different researchers since 200,000 sequences were recently uploaded into public databases. You turn your attention now to slide number 47. I just want to spend a few minutes talking about validation of the arrays. Since microarrays are a fairly new technology in the ecotoxicology field, I published some studies in early 2000. Right around there, work by my group and others, really that was the first studies to look at different species, rainbow trout, sheephead minnows, bass, largemouth bass, using microarray technology. Now, whenever you have a new technology such as microarrays, you really need to go through some extensive validation looking at how reproducible microarrays are, how exactly they work in various researchers' hands. Now, so what we did was we examined the reproducibility of these microarrays. And this work, I'm going to highlight this work. It could be found in a study I recently published with Gary Ankley's group in EPNC. The reference to that article is shown on the bottom of slide number 47. So one way to validate microarrays is to take an RNA sample shown in this diagram, RNA1. Remember, we used a reference design, so that's just shown as RNA sample number 2. We labeled the two RNA samples with two different cyan dyes, and then so we hybridized the messenger RNA sequences, mixed the samples together, and essentially applied the samples onto two different microarrays. Now, since you, so essentially it's looking at the reproducibility of the arrays, how consistent, you should see the same gene expression pattern on one microarray compared to another if you use the exact same sample. Shown in on panel B on the right, so we plotted, or I plotted all the gene expression patterns from array A on the y-axis and then array B on the x-axis. And what you can see based on the R-square of 0.94, a fairly tight correlation of all the data points, suggesting that at least these arrays are pretty reproducible. So we were pretty relieved to see that we saw reproducible data from one array to another. So you turn your attention now to slide number 48. We also did a slightly different validation, slightly different validation parameters where we looked at to see how reproducible different probes were for the same gene. We designed multiple 60-mers along a gene, vitellogenin. Probably many of you are very familiar with the vitellogenin gene. It's a well-known biomarker for 17 beta estradiol, as well as other compounds that mimic estrogens. So what we did was we exposed, and this work was done with Gary Ankley's group at Duluth EPA. He exposed male fathead minnows for 24 hours to 17 beta estradiol, and for this array, we designed multiple probes for the along the VTG1 gene. For the 24-hour exposure, we did two different doses. Which is 100 nanograms per liter, which is the open circles in the graph, and then the closed circles are 40 nanograms per liter. So we used a fairly short dose. And what we found was a pretty wide range of gene expression to fold change values for various probes. The average VTG1 fold change level for the low dose was about 13 plus or minus 8, and then the average VTG level fold change for the high dose was about 76 plus or minus 47. So it was pretty widely spread out. Now, based on this data, what we found was that the fold change results vary quite a bit along the VTG1 gene. We saw a correlation that depended on probe location, whether it was at the 5' end of the gene or at the 3' end of the gene. So due to the variability that we saw in probe performance, it was pretty fortuitous that we actually designed our chips, the 2000 gene chip, using multiple probes for each gene. And that's something I really recommend all researchers do. Don't just design one probe to analyze the arrays, but look at multiple probes. So for the RNIP analysis, what we did was I averaged the values for multiple probes and found more consistent data doing that. So slide number 49, I'm not going to go through that table. You could read most of it yourselves. This is various genes that were differentially regulated in male liver. So we used pretty standard statistical measures. We used t-tests. The p-value for our cutoff for significance was p less than 0.01. So the genes that were upregulated are shown on the top, and or downregulated, I'm sorry, are shown at the top, and genes that are upregulated in livers of RNIP-exposed male fatheminnows compared to controls are shown at the bottom. So the genes that were differentially regulated encode a number of different proteins. Some are involved in tissue repair, inflammation, which is the first line of defense against foreign chemicals or organisms. There are also genes that are part of antioxidant defenses. To put this in perspective, compared to other array studies that I've done in fathead minnows, largemouth bass, and sheepshead minnows, as well as blue crab, work with Mary Sprower's group, very few genes were found to be significantly changed. So out of 2,000, these were the ones that were up or down regulated in liver. The next slide, slide number 50, there's only one gene that was significantly downregulated in gills of males exposed to RNIP. And that one's listed on the table. I also included some references on the right that explains the functions of each of the genes. So in conclusion, so slide 51, we found a number of different things. One was that RNIP is considered slightly toxic based on the Daphne exposure studies that Avis group did. And then one thing she also found was the concentration of RNIP, 50 ppm, used in the fatheminnow studies didn't cause any overt physical changes like lesions or mortality in the fish. Now, based on not seeing any physical changes, we wouldn't necessarily expect to see any or many genes that would be significantly up or down regulated. That's actually what we confirmed with the arrays. We saw very few genes that were significantly changed in both the gill and the liver tissue. So we saw fairly good concordance of the in vivo and the array data. And this was one of the first studies sort of comparing more traditional assays like in vivo exposures to up-and-coming technology like microarrays. So sort of laid the groundwork just to look at, we only looked at one concentration at one dose. I mean, one could run a lot more exposures for longer lengths of time, but this had to start somewhere. And that's it.
Thanks, Dr. Larkin.
No problem.
Let's move into our question and answer period. I'd like to begin with the phone participants. If you have a question for Dr. Larkin, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, while they're getting their thoughts together, I have a couple that have been submitted by Martin Griffin from Wisconsin DNR in Madison. In slide number 40, you show that RNIP can coat Daphnia at varying concentrations. Even though they survived, have you looked at the behaviors of the Daphnia at these varying stages? For example, did they increase molting behavior? If so, an increase in molting may make the Daphnia more vulnerable to predation and affect overall survival rate.
Yeah, that's a good question you bring up. I don't believe Ava looked at some behavioral see if there's any behavioral modifications in the Daphnia. I mean, that's something definitely she should consider doing to see if molting or other factors will be affected. That's a good question.
Okay, on a follow-up, also from Martin Griffin, he was wondering if the fathead minnow exposure design included looking at effects on egg or larval fish development.
This one didn't. Gary Ankley's reproductive studies typically go about 21 days for chronic exposure. So the next step would be to do different doses of RNIP and also look at reproductive fecundity, fertility. So those would definitely be follow-up studies, good follow-up studies to be run. So we haven't done that yet, but that would be a good next step.
Okay. Let's check back with our phone participants. If you have a question for Dr. Larkin, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and your organization.
This is Warren Wayne again, Region 5. Can you say something about how you characterize the nano-zero-valent iron particle? And why you chose to name it something different from everybody else in the field? I was just curious.
Ask that again? I couldn't hear you.
I said, you know, that these are nano-zero-valent iron particles, right? How does the word reactive change anything? And how were they produced? What method? Were they Borel hydride produced? Were they synthesized from the bottom up? Do you know anything about their, I don't know, any characterization of the particles at all to show that you're using the same particle each time you do an experiment?
Right. Yeah, that was, so if you focus your attention on slide 35, we received the material from CODA. So they've done a lot of characterization of the particles themselves. But I don't believe Ava looked at size of the particles in her laboratory. So that is a consideration to see how consistent surface areas the particles are. Someone mentioned in the for the first talk to look at surface area in relation to concentration. So those are all actually may have been new. Those are all good studies. See if the toxicity data changes based on surface area or size of the particles.
And basically you saw no effect, as far as I can see, or no significant effect on the daphne, is that right?
Right.
We saw
coating of the particles. Now, we did fairly short-term exposures. I mean, it would be nice to, as one of the previous participants that asked the question, to look to see if there's any changes in molting, sort of do some follow-up life cycle tests. But based on this very acute exposure, 48 hours, that's really short, we didn't see any very toxic effects.
And I'm not a geneticist, so can you kind of sum up what the genetic experiment means?
Can you ask that one more time?
Could you please sum up what the array experiment demonstrates? I mean, I'm not a geneticist, so I'm struggling over here trying to understand.
What it can show, are you asking?
What did it show?
I think I heard your question. You're breaking up a little. Gene arrays, you can get at more subtle effects than just looking at toxicity, like looking at LC50 values. So you can get ideas about which pathways may be affected. So instead of just counting how many daphne or phaeninas live or die from traditional tests, you can get more subtle responses. To get at which specific pathways, whether it's pathways in the liver or in steroidogenesis, might be affected by various compounds. Sites that have mixed effluents, some work I did in sheepshead minnows, one of the potential advantages of microarrays is to be able to discriminate against compounds in a mixed effluent. I mean, it's still really preliminary, but I did some work that may be able to distinguish between different types of estrogenic compounds. So, does that sort of answer your question, or?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay, let's stay with our phone participants. If you have a question for Dr. Larkin, please introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, while they're thinking, I'd like to check and see if we have Dr. Claney still with us. Dr. Claney, are you still on the line?
I'm here.
Okay, great. I've got a Just a couple remaining questions. Let me ask this one that came in from, excuse me. This question is from Zhangmin Wang at University of Missouri, Rolla. He says, you concluded that natural organic matter can stabilize carbon nanoparticles. However, in slide 18, there is no control sample that contains only nanoparticles and water. Can you expand your explanation a little further?
Our experience has been that you have to use a tremendous amount of energy to disperse these carbon nanoparticles in a aqueous suspension, and that those suspensions are very unstable. As I mentioned earlier, that if you use a lot of energy, say through sonication, and I mean sonication for several hours, and this is using a probe sonicator, not a sonicator bath, you run the risk of surface modifying these carbon nanoparticles and actually taking, say, fullerenes and producing fullerols, and in which case those are definitely more stable in the water column. So that's one of the reasons why there's no tube that has just the particles in it, because they don't stay in suspension very long at all. It wasn't a total oversight, and I realize that it does draw some apprehension in that there is no conclusion or there's no comparison, but tubes that would have no NOM and only nanoparticles would look very similar to the ones to the single wall nanotube test tube, tube E. That's why they're not shown.
Okay, Dr. Kleene, I have one additional question that was left over from earlier. Let's go ahead and get this one out of the way. This is also from Martin Griffin from Wisconsin DNR in Madison. Pardon me. The reproduction slide showed that at 1 milligram per liter and lower, that reproduction is affected. Does it make sense to create a nanoparticle suspension that is 25 milligrams per liter? In other words, what is the real-life concentrations that we will see in the environment? And how does that translate into real-life effects to filter feeders?
That's a good point. And I don't have – it's really difficult to predict what kind of real-world exposures are going to be there, because if you look at just mass of carbon nanoparticles produced, and you can just pick one, say fullerenes or single-wall nanotubes, there's quite a large mass that are being produced and used. What this translates into in terms of amount getting into aqueous ecosystems is hard to determine. The reason we chose, after working with these for a little while, we simply chose the 25 in order to get a stable suspension that we could then dilute down to get a range of concentrations that we could use in our experiments. Actually, we could use the same procedure for getting the 25 to start off with a 1, for instance, and then to loop down from there. So that's simply an artifact of the procedure. It doesn't reflect our belief in what is a natural, what kind of exposures are occurring in the environment. In fact, that's an excellent area to discuss, because one could argue that it's going to be very difficult to take a bucket, go out and get a liter of water and measure how many nanoparticles are in there and differentiate natural from anthropogenic nanoparticles.
Okay, I'd like to mention to everyone in the audience that we can now take questions for both presenters. Dr. Kleene is still with us. Dr. Larkin just finished his talk, the second talk. So if you have a question for either presenter, please, if you want to direct it to one of them, that's fine. But please introduce yourself and name your organization.
This is Eric Orsak. I'm with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Las Vegas, and I have a question for Dr. Larkin.
Uh-huh.
It's actually, I appreciate your presentation and particularly the sort of fundamentals of microarray, since that's an emerging technology that I'm less familiar with. And my question has less to do with the nanoparticle side of your presentation, but slide 49 that shows the different genes that were expressed, under or overexpressed. You mentioned your work with other aquatic organisms, I think sheep's head minnow, and exposures to effluent and multiple stressors. Any literature you can point me at that might give me some of these same types of results you show on slide 49 for that type of exposure scenario?
For nanoparticles or for compounds and anthropogenic compounds in general?
Anthropogenic, the wastewater effluent exposures, that type of scenario.
Yeah, I can't. If you email me, I'll respond and send you some articles by email. I'll have to look up a few. We did laboratory exposures. Do you want laboratory exposures or field samples for effluent?
Either one that would give me some indication of the types of changes that you that were indicated in fish that were exposed to effluents.
Okay. Yeah, I can send you a couple PDF articles of those.
Okay, thank you. I'll send an email.
Yeah. The one article, the EPNC one, I did with Gary Ankley's group. That one we looked at estradiol, which is and with these technologies, one of the challenges is to start a baseline of gene expression patterns and then work up from there. So we chose a compound whose mode of action is fairly well known. So we looked for like coryogens, zitalogenin, ER-alpha, certain genes that we knew should be significantly changed. And I mean, that was a little bit of an easier approach than looking, validating with the nanoparticles like RNIP, where you're not sure what's normal. So we had to sort of develop a baseline as we went using this new technology. But as more and more researchers start using these tools and make gene array data publicly available, it'll be easier to cross-reference samples and things.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll stay with our phone participants. If you have a question for either of today's presenters, please name your organization and introduce yourself and name your organization.
This is Keith Esch from Research Triangle Institute. I have a question for Dr. Claney. You mentioned, or you showed that the natural organic material had sort of a variable ability to allow the suspension to be stable. And you, in a previous call, asked about other surfactants in addition to the lysophospholipid. And what I wondered is if with those other surfactants or the lysophospholipid, you saw the same kind of variability.
Dr. Claney, you still with us?
I apologize. I had my phone on mute.
I hate it when that happens.
I'm talking away. And are you talking about the variability that I showed with the different sources of natural organic matter and the 96-hour LC50s for multi-well nanotubes?
No, I'm talking about the variability with the same natural organic material, but with different types of carbon nanoparticles.
Oh, you're talking about the slide where I had the test tubes.
Yes, that's right, slide 18.
Okay, all right, thanks. Okay, when we've looked at surfactants, we have not. We, meaning the royal we, all the physicist here, actually, has looked primarily at fullerenes and single wall nanotubes, and more recently multi wall, but hasn't looked at have not done the complete array of carbon nanoparticles and surfactants. As I will tell you that the lysophosphatidylcholine, the lysophospholipid that we used with the single wall nanotubes, worked with C60, but doesn't work very well with C70, and that's why they went with the gallic acid. So it doesn't appear that, at least that limited amount of data would suggest that maybe they don't work equally well with all kinds of carbon nanomaterials.
Okay, thanks.
Welcome. Sorry, I don't have more information on that.
This is Warren Lane in Region 5 again. You've shown your results for liver. Are they substantially different or the same with the gill tissue? Because you mentioned that you looked at that too. Oh, I see. I see this one slide, 50. Okay, gotcha. Never mind.
That was an easy one. Okay, I have one here. I'd like to read from one final question, or at least one other question, from Martin Griffin, Wisconsin DNR in Madison. By the way, thank you very much for all the great questions, Mr. Griffin. They've been excellent. This question is a more general question for both presenters, and Martin begins it by saying great job to both of you, by the way. The question is, does your respective groups or labs work cooperatively with other groups or labs at your institutions? For example, it was pointed out that if you cannot measure the real-world nanoparticle concentration or distinguish between anthropogenic versus natural nanoparticles, how relevant will tox studies be if the real-world concentration never reaches experimental values? So have you been working with labs to develop ways to monitor or measure baseline nanoparticle concentrations? And that question was for both of you, by the way.
Well, I'll take a shot at it first, if that's okay with you, Patrick.
Sure.
There's been I think the RFP, the request for proposals, just ended, but there was a request for proposals for to develop methods to quantify nanoparticles in natural media, in environmental media. To my knowledge, while there are people who now have obviously put in proposals for that, I don't know a lot of people who are actually trying to quantify nanoparticles in environmental media. We do collaborate with a lot of different laboratories, both at our institution as well as other institutions. And some of those collaborators are listed in my presentation. And I really, you know, this field is so different from looking at solutes, that I think it gives us some amazing opportunities to collaborate with folks like physicists and material scientists who characterize particles and have a lot more experience in this area. And so I think interdisciplinary collaboration is going to be critical to make headway in this field. So I hope that helps answer some of the question.
Yeah, I mean, essentially expand upon what Dr. Rainey's talking about. I mean, you really need to collaborate with a number of different groups. I mean, microarrays and then exposure, looking at working with toxicologists for exposures and physical scientists to really get at the questions about how these particles react or not with various organisms.
Okay, let's check back with our phone participants one more time. If you have a question for either of today's presenters, please introduce yourself and name your organization. Great. I think we may have reached the end. Let me make a few conclusory comments here, and I'll check back one more quick time if you're still holding for a question. I'd just like to remind the audience, please, to fill out the feedback form. You can find a link to it from the seminar webpage, and we'd love to have comments on this seminar and also suggestions for additional seminars or additional series. And I'd also like to remind you the final session in this series is scheduled for November 8th. The registration will be open by the first of the month in November when the Tech Direct newsletter goes out. I'd like to thank Dr. Steve Claney, Clemson University, and Dr. Patrick Larkin from Santa Fe Community College in Florida for presenting today. I think this has been a great session in this series. And with that, I'd like to just check back to the audience one final time to see if there's anybody hanging on with any final questions. If you have a question for either presenter, please introduce yourself and name your organization.
This is Chuck Maurice in Region 5 again, and I just wanted to thank Dr. Claney and Dr. Larkin. I think that both of you, I'll repeat what the other commenter stated, that I think you did a wonderful job in promoting this field forward.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I think we'll go ahead and close today's session. I would remind anybody still on the line, if you have additional questions, the contact information for today's speaker is are on the seminar webpage, and you can continue to send questions. Thank you very much, and we'll see you in about 3 weeks for the final session in this series. Good day. All right.